The topic I want to address, I hope there's enough copies of the source sheet. If not, please maybe share with the person next to you or whatever. More copies over here? Anybody else back there? Whoa. Oh, sorry. The main purpose of what I'd like to get across in this morning's shiur is to correct what I perceive as a major misperception that seems to be very prevalent in the Jewish community today. I think if you would ask Jews living in America in our time, how should I phrase this exactly? What do you think about non-Jews and our relationship with them and what it should be? I think you'd get one of two very different answers. Most non-Orthodox Jews in America today, and I think some Orthodox Jews as well, would give you an answer that might seem like a page out of Barack Obama's book. You know, really we're all one big multicultural society, all children of the same God. We have different cultures perhaps, different religions perhaps, but really we're all the same and we should view ourselves as one, you know, really one sort of greater, or in a part of one greater whole. On the other hand, I think many, perhaps most Orthodox Jews, would give you an answer that's basically the polar opposite of that, and would say, basically, look, we Jews are completely supposed to be separate from the Goyim, and our attitude towards Goyim will probably range somewhere between hostility and ambivalence. In other words, in some people's minds you might get a very negative attitude, a very, very almost hostile sort of undertone. And I think the more moderate voices in the Orthodox community usually view non-Jews as basically irrelevant. Our goal is to serve God, our goal is to observe the Torah, and all these billions of people that inhabit the earth, you know, they're just there. And my purpose is to correct this misconception. I think both of those approaches are wrong. I don't think I have to spend too much time kind of refuting the Barack Obama ideology and making the point that we're supposed to be separate from the Goyim. I think that those of us who study Torah and Halakha and live by Halakha make it, I think the Halakha does a very good job, both in conceptual terms and in very practical terms, of making sure that we maintain a certain distance from the Goyim and realizing that we are different. We say this in our tefillot all the time, Baruch Elokeinu Shebra'anu L'Chvodo V'Hivdilanu Min HaSoyim. Just last night we said the bracha HaMavdil Bein Kodesh L'Chol Or L'Koshes Bein Yisrael L'Amin. I think we understand that we are different, but I actually want to address the other side of the equation and point out that I think the attitude that says that Goyim are irrelevant to us, I think is significantly flawed. And I'd like to show you why. I saw a film recently, a very interesting film that came out about a year or two ago called Hiding and Seeking. Anybody see it? One person? Two people? Very interesting. Three. Okay. Four. Okay. There is a fellow who, they don't know where this man lives, Menachem Daum?
Yeah,
Borough Park. Okay. A Flatbush. Say this. This man, who I guess is a filmmaker, because he made a film, I assume he's a professional filmmaker, very interesting film that he made. He's the son and son-in-law of Holocaust survivors. So he's a second generation, he and his wife both. And he has children who are learning in Yerushalayim and Haredi kolels in Yerushalayim. And he does this kind of intergenerational thing where, you know, he talks to his father and his in-laws about their experiences and the attitude they had towards non-Jews. he goes to Yerushalayim and talks to his children, who have heard and picked up, you know, sort of a, you know, ideology that really all that matters in the world is us and our Torah and our mitzvot, and you know, those non-Jews, we have nothing to do with them. We don't, that they're just, again, irrelevant. And then he actually takes them to Poland, and he finds the old couple that saved his father-in-law, and it's a very interesting film. And basically, he's got this running debate with his sons that goes on throughout the film, where his sons are saying, "Dad, you know, Goyim are irrelevant or worse," and he's trying to show them, "No, that you know, there's value in all human beings." I found my own feelings to be somewhere in between himself and his children, but what I want to try to get across is a point that when I say it, and I'm going to say it in a way that might sound even a bit provocative, but I think I'll be able to prove this to you by the end of this year, that the Torah let me put it to you this way. We don't expect, and I'll show you this in the sources in a moment, we don't expect non-Jews to become Jewish. We don't expect them to join Am Yisrael. The point has been made many, many times that we may be the only faith community today that doesn't proselytize, that doesn't go out trying to attract others to join our community. However, we do expect all people on this earth to believe the Torah and to follow the Torah. Perhaps that sounds like a contradiction. I said we don't expect them to become Jewish, and I said we expect them to follow the Torah. But that's exactly what the sources tell us. Let me start with two sources that those of you who took my Am Levadat Yishkon class probably have heard from me before. The Torah is filled with sources. The Torah, the Tanakh, is filled with sources that speak about our responsibility towards the rest of the world and what our vision is for the rest of the world. I'm not going to go through all of them. I'll give you one source from the very beginning of Jewish history, the very, very beginning, and one source from the very, very end of Jewish history. And the first two sources on the page there. The first source, a psukim that we're all familiar with, this is the very dawn of the notion of Am Yisrael. When Avraham Avinu, who was mentioned earlier this morning, was selected for the mission. Vayomer Hashem al Avraham, lech lecha me'artzecha, me'mo'aretzecha mi'beit avicha la'aretz asher arecha. This is the great mission of Avraham Avinu, who was called to separate himself off, cut himself off from everything he knew, and to go off into the sunset to an unknown destination, and what's the purpose of this? He's told, he's given all these promises, you'll be famous, you'll be blessed, you'll have all sorts of positive things. And then, v'nivrichu v'cha kol mishpachot ha'adama. From the very first moment Avraham Avinu was told, the reason for which you have been chosen is not for yourself and not for your descendants that I'm constantly telling you are going to be as numerous as the stars in the sky, and not for privilege, but ultimately for responsibility towards kol mishpachot ha'adama, the entire world. We'll jump from that all the way to the end of history. And Yishayahu HaNavi tells us in the second source, Hadavar asher chaza Yishayahu ben Amos al Yehuda ve Yerushalayim, v'haya b'acharit hayamim. This is the vision that Yishayahu sees for the end of day. V'haya b'acharit hayamim nachon yeh har beit Hashem b'rosh ha'arim v'nisan migvaot. Yishayahu sees the Beit HaMikdash, the Har HaBayit, metaphorically rising above all other mountains, becoming a rallying point. V'naharu elav kol hagoyim. All nations, Yishayahu sees a vision, come streaming to Yerushalayim. V'halchu amin rabin v'amru. What are these people doing? Why are they all coming to Yerushalayim? They're coming and saying the following words. V'chu v'na'ale el har Hashem el beit elokei Yaakov. V'yoreinu midrachav v'nelcha b'yorchotav. We want to learn God's ways. We want to follow them. Ki mitzion teitze Torah udvar Hashem Yerushalayim. We all know that pasuk. How many of us realize that in that pasuk, when the Torah goes forth from Yerushalayim, from Tzion, who's it going to? It's going to the Goyim. Just read the pasuk. That's what it says. And the result of this will be the Shafat Ben Agoyim, Lochiach Lamim Rabim, Vechititu Charvotam Li'itim Vechanitoteim and Azmirot. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks, I think it's normally translated. Lo Yisagoy El Goy Cherev Velo Yimudu Od Milchama. So both from the point in which Avraham Avinu was chosen through to the vision of the end of days, which is the goal of all history, we see that Am Yisrael stands at the center of a movement that's supposed to encompass all of humanity. Avraham Avinu's mission is V'nivruchu b'chad kol mishpachot ha'adama. The vision of the end of days has the Beit HaMikdash and Am Yisrael, Beit Elokei Yaakov, as those who lead and instruct and guide all of humanity. And the Rambam tells us this in source number 3 in Hilchot Melachim, in the 8th chapter of Hilchot Melachim. I'll just read a piece of this, and I will return to the source in a few minutes. But if you look there at the first thing there, source number 3, Halacha Yud, Moshe Rabbeinu lo hinchila Torah and mitzvot elo Yisrael. Torah and mitzvot were given only to Am Yisrael. Shenemar, Morasha, Kihilat Yaakov. Torah and mitzvot are only for us. V'lechol ha-rotzeh li-hitgayer mi-sha'ar ha-umot. Shenemar kachem kager. Aval mi sha'lo rotzeh, ein kofin oto l'kabel Torah u-mitzvot. Torah u-mitzvot is for Am Yisrael, and it's also available for anybody who voluntarily chooses to join Am Yisrael. We have a concept of giur. Any non-Jew, any non-member of Am Yisrael who wants to join, although we don't go out and encourage it, and we certainly don't force it, that option is available. And they can join our ranks. But if they don't want to, we don't press them to. However, the Chen Tziva Moshe Rabbeinu Mipi Agvura Lakuf Kol Ba'ei Olam L'Kabel Mitzvot Shenitztavu B'nei Noach. But there are mitzvot in the Torah that apply to all of humanity. As the children of Noach, long before Avraham Avinu, were commanded in, and these mitzvot we do actually even theoretically force. The Rambam says, "B'chol mishol yikabel yehareg," even on penalty of death, assuming obviously that we have the capability of doing so. We'll come back to this source in a little while. So there's this concept that there is a set of mitzvot that apply to all human beings. And actually the next two chapters in the Rambam, if you ever want to study, that this is the end of chapter 8 in Hilchot Melachim, chapters 9 and 10 of Hilchot Melachim comprise what you might call a treatise on the Torah's attitude towards non-Jews, towards Bnei Noach. What is the Torah speaking, what is the Torah saying to all those billions of people on this planet who are not members of Am Yisrael? And it basically outlines their obligations, their responsibilities, and our responsibilities to them in two succinct chapters. It's worth reading. We're going to look at a few selections from it in a moment. In fact, let's start right now. Let's look at source number 4. If a non-Jew comes to me and says, okay, you've told me that if I want to, I can join your community and accept all of your responsibilities, but I'm not obligated to do so, you're not encouraging me to do so, and frankly, I'm not interested in doing so. So we all agree. What do you, from your vantage point, what do you people who follow this Torah of yours, what do you have to say to me? What is my obligation? What is my place in this world? Who am I in your eyes? What's my role? So I can pull out Hilchot Melachim Perek Tet, and I can tell him the following. Al shisha dvarim, says the Rambam, nitztava adam harishon. There were 6 laws, the Rambam says. I know people probably expected the number 7. We'll see that in a moment. We'll see that the number isn't going to be 7 either, but we'll see the number 7 in a minute. But there were 6 laws that already Adam HaRishon was commanded in. These laws are generally referred to as the laws of Bnei Noach. There's a whole discussion in the Gemara about whether these laws, all of them applied even before Noach or maybe not. The Rambam's opinion is a machloket about it. Everyone agrees that even from the days of Adam HaRishon there were certain laws. Adam HaRishon, for example, was commanded not to be an idolater, not to worship idols. According to the Rambam, there were 6 laws that were commanded to Adam HaRishon, and they are al Avodah Zarah, the prohibition of idolatry, via Birkat Hashem. Birkat Hashem is what's called Lashon Sadi Nahor. It's a reversal. It really means cursing God. And that's a prohibition for Bnei Adam. Ve'al shvichut damin, the prohibition of murder. Ve'al gilui arayot, the prohibition of adultery, incest, and other forbidden sexual relationships. Ve'al gezel, prohibition of theft. Ve'al hadinim, and an obligation of setting up laws, system of laws in every society. Laws that regulate people's interactions with one another, law and order. The Torah didn't, God didn't give these laws to the non-Jewish world as He did to us, but He commanded them to set up in their own societies systems of justice, including police force, and including court system, and everything that you need to have a properly ordered society where there's justice. That was also a commandment to Adam HaRishon. Six laws: Avodah Zarah, Birkat Hashem, Gilui Arayot, Shfichut Damim, Gezel, and Din. These six laws were commanded on Adam HaRishon. And then, he writes, Af al-pi shekulan hein kabbalah b'yadein Moshe Rabbeinu. Even though we know this from Moshe Rabbeinu, all these things, after all, are part of our Torah. Ve'adat no telahem, and they're also all pretty logical. They're the kind of things you would come up with on your own anyway. Michlal divrei Torah yireh shal elu nitztava. And then hosif lenoach eiver min hachai, shenemar ach pasar v'nafsho demo lo tochilu. Noach was given a seventh law. See, Adam HaRishon was not allowed to eat meat. He was only allowed to eat vegetables or plants. After Noah, the Torah gave permission to human beings to eat animals, and therefore there was one restriction that was placed on Noah, not to eat Eiver min hachai, not to eat a piece of an animal that's still alive. In other words, Ben Noah is allowed to kill an animal, doesn't have to be through Shechita, he's not limited to what animals, he can eat all animals, not like we who are only allowed to eat certain animals. He can kill the animal using any method he wants, and then he can eat the animal. But if the animal's still alive, just to cut off the animal's leg, or even if it comes off by itself, and he finds the leg of an animal on the ground because it got into an accident, and he says, oh, this is a waste, I may as well eat it. So that's prohibited. It's called Eiver min hachai, and that's the seventh law, which was, according to Rambam, wasn't given to Adam HaRishon because it was irrelevant, because he wasn't allowed to eat meat anyway. That was given to Noah. And therefore, you have what's called Nimtzu Sheva Mitzvot. These are the famous, well-known Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach. Seven laws that apply to B'nei Noach. Who are B'nei Noach? Basically, all human beings on planet Earth. Everybody's a child of Noach. Right? Because everybody else was like that. So when we use the phrase B'nei Noach, is actually a synonym for human being. So there are seven laws, therefore, that apply to all human beings. There are something like 6 billion people on planet Earth today. Then the Torah is saying that 6 billion people are obligated to keep these seven laws. The truth is, there's a lot more than seven. If you go to the Gemara points out, first of all, that even the seven laws have multiple details, and maybe, for example, Gilui Arayot is really a collection of, for Bnei Noach, of 6 different laws. And there are numerous details. There also may be other mitzvot that, for one reason or another, aren't included in this list. This list is basically mitzvot lo taseh. According to the certain opinions in the Gemara, there may be certain mitzvot aseh that they're also obligated in. Some opinions, for example, think that the Menoach are obligated to give tzedakah, for example. There's a source in the Gemara in Chulin that actually says that there are 30 laws for Bnei Noach. So, we don't have time today to try to figure all these things out and all the different opinions. And not only that, even those who hold 7, there are different opinions in the Gemara. This list of 7, there are others who argue that remove one or two of them and replace them with others. Kishuf or Seirut, there are different opinions in the Gemara. Maybe Kilayim, believe it or not. But right now my purpose is less to focus on the details and more on the concept. There is a corpus of law we can refer to it as Zion Mitzvot or Sheva Mitzvot. We can speak of that, those 7, and perhaps certain ancillary additional laws. There is a corpus of law which applies and which obligates Bnei Noach from the Torah. Now, Am Yisrael comes from, who today is Am Yisrael? So the people that today are called Am Yisrael are first of all the biological descendants of Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, plus anyone who joined Am Yisrael through the process of Giyur, and all of their descendants, right? But all of us are also the children of God. Adam HaRishonim, I keep saying Adam HaRishonim, I'm sorry, Abraham Avinu. Did I say Adam HaRishonim a minute ago? Abraham Avinu. Abraham Avinu was himself a Ben Noach. And so was Yitzchak and so was Yaakov, and so were their descendants, and so were those who stood at Sinai and received the Torah, and so are all of us. And therefore, perhaps we would develop the following model in our heads, which would, I'll show you in a minute, be incorrect. Perhaps we could develop the following model and think, okay, there's like concentric circles here. There's B'nai Noach. Anyone who's a Ben Noach is obligated in the corpus of laws, let's call them Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach. That includes the people in China, and that includes the people in Russia, and includes the people in Argentina, and also includes Am Yisrael. It includes all human beings. Then there's a separate law, a separate set of laws that refers, that applies to Am Yisrael. So that I might think, okay, I'm obligated in the Mitzvot B'nai Noach as a Ben Noach, and I'm obligated also in the Torah as a part of Am Yisrael. We might think that, but we'd be wrong. And I'll prove it to you. First of all, I'm trying to figure out if I should first prove it empirically or first prove it textually. I'll start with empirically. We go through the laws of the B'nai Noach, and if you study them, I'm going to give you a few examples of this. You will see the following phenomena. All of the mitzvot of B'nai Noach also apply to Am Yisrael. However, the details are often different. Sometimes they're stricter on us. Sometimes, many times even, they're stricter dafka on them. I'll give you one example of each. I mentioned this already earlier. The mitzvah of Gilui Arayot, the prohibition of Gilui Arayot, applies to B'nai Noach and applies to B'nai Yisrael, but differently. B'nai Noach have a total of 6 arayot. There are 6 forbidden relationships. Am Yisrael, I don't remember the exact number, but it's in the 20s or 30s, if I'm not mistaken. In other words, there are many types of relationships that are considered Gilui Arayot for Am Yisrael and are not considered Gilui Arayot for a Ben Noach. So that's an example where we have the same law, but the definition is different. It's much stricter on us than it is on them. The opposite, though, is also often the case. Take a look, again, in source number 4, in the Rambam there, Halacha Dalet. The Issur of Ritzicha, the Issur of murder, obviously applies to all B'nai Noach. They're prohibited. They're not allowed to murder people. And we also are prohibited from committing murder. However, the definition of what constitutes murder is different. In Halacha Dalet, they write, Ben Noach Shaharag Nefesh Afilu Ubar B'me'ei Imo Neherag Alav. A non-Jew, Ben Noach, is considered a murderer even for killing a fetus. In other words, for performing an abortion. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but the whole debate about abortion, the Catholic Church considers abortion to be murder. And Halacha actually, does, generally speaking, for Jews, does not consider abortion to be murder. It's prohibited, but it's not murder. And that's why, for example, in a case where, God forbid, there's a health emergency and the mother's life is endangered by the pregnancy, the Catholic Church would argue that you're still not allowed to perform an abortion, even if the mother is going to die. And if we considered it murder, we'd say the same way. Would we allow you to kill one person in order to save another person? Certainly not. But we would allow an abortion to be performed in a case where there's a threat to the life of the mother because it's not considered murder. But, says the Rambam, for a goy, it is considered murder. I'm Kidei Kaf. I heard many years ago from Rabbi Willig, my Rebbe Rabbi Willig, he paskins lahalacha. That if God forbid a person's in a situation where she's pregnant and there's a health emergency and needs an abortion in a situation where the Torah permits it, you should doctor go and find a Jewish doctor to perform the abortion. Doctor, Jewish doctor. Because for a non-Jewish doctor, it would be us. And not only that, there are other examples. The chayin, Imharag Trefa. if there was a person who was unfortunately dying, someone on their deathbed, and whether an act of euthanasia or for some other reason the person goes and kills this person who was, so to speak, almost dead already, that's not permitted, but we wouldn't execute a person as a murderer for that, a Jew. Or if a person kills a person through an indirect sort of way, shekfato v'natno lefi ari, guy ties someone up and leaves them where there's a hungry lion. Didn't actually kill him, but he's dying. He just, you know, created a situation, ties the person up on the railroad track, something like that. In all these cases, a Jew would not be executed as a murderer, even though it's prohibited, but a goy would be. So you see that the definition of what constitutes murder is actually stricter for a ben Noach than it is for Am Yisrael. So we have certain laws where the definition is stricter on us than it is on them. We have certain laws where the definition is stricter in many cases, where the definition is, I just gave you one example, but there are numerous others, where the definition is stricter for them than it is for us. There are also some cases where it's identical. The Rambam here in Halacha Bet points out that the definition of what constitutes Avodah Zarah is actually identical. Whatever is considered Avodah Zarah for a Jew is considered Avodah Zarah for a Goy, and vice versa. But the point is that this seems to imply, we'd have to study and try to figure out in each case why the details are as they are, and why in this case it's stricter on us, and why in this case it's stricter on them, what the reason behind each of these particular nuances is, and we don't have time to do that now, but one thing I think that emerges from this is that although the same laws apply to us as apply to them, the obligation apparently stems from a different source. I may be obligated to keep, roughly speaking, the same laws as B'nai Noach, but apparently I am not a Ben Noach. Because if I will be, then at the very least it cannot be that something that's permissible, that's prohibited to him, is permissible to me. That can't be. And in fact, the Halakha says exactly this. That was the empirical proof. Now I'll give you the textual proof. In source number 5, the Gemara Nedarim. There's a Mishnah Nedarim there. Konam she'eini mehen el B'nai Noach. A person can take what's called a konam, it's a form of a nezek. One sort of thing that a person can do, if a person undertakes a vow, that I will not benefit from anything having to do with this person. Konam hanami so-and-so. If I would say, you know, I'm not going to pick anyone's name, because you usually do this if you're in a fight with somebody, right? But, you know, this person who's sitting in this chair here, you know, I take a note that I'm not going to have any hana from that person. It would then become prohibited for me to benefit in any way from that person or any of their property. That's the law of Nidar. Let's say a person says, Konam she'eini mehene livnei noach. This guy just got himself into a mess. He just committed himself through a vow not to have any benefit from any of the B'nai Noach. In other words, sounds like from any person, right? He now is not allowed to have any benefit from any other human being. Or so you would think. The Mishnah says, Mutter b'Yisrael v'Asur v'Ovei Kochav. That person is not allowed to have any benefit from any person who's not part of Am Yisrael. But from Am Yisrael he is. And the Gemara points out, V'Yisrael mi'nafik nichlal b'nei Noach. I don't understand. He said, he took a vow not to have any benefit from any B'nai Noach. Am Yisrael are also B'nai Noach. Are they not? Answered the Gemara, apparently not. Kevan v'it kadash Avraham it karu al shmei. Obviously, genealogically, all of us are descended from Noach. But we're not considered B'nai Noach. We were B'nai Noach once upon a time. But when we stood at Sinai and received the Torah, we became removed from the category of B'nai Noach, and now we're obligated by the Torah. Now it happens to be, and of course this is not by accident, it happens to be that all the laws that are included in the corpus of mitzvot B'nai Noach are also, although with sometimes differing details and definitions, but those same laws are included in the corpus of what's called Torah and mitzvah. So it's not that an entire obligation that we used to have as B'nai Noach was removed from us entirely. We have the same obligations, but the obligation comes from a different source. B'nai Noach is obligated in the mitzvah of B'nai Noach. We are not obligated in the mitzvah of B'nai Noach. We are obligated in Torah and mitzvah. And even those mitzvah which overlap with B'nai Noach, our obligation does not come from the fact that we're B'nai Noach. In fact, halachically, we are not B'nai Noach. And that's what that Mishnah in Nedarim proves. And yet, we have the same laws. Or similar laws. And what does that mean? Let's stop and think about that for a second. What is the conceptual message that that has for us? That on the one hand, we're not B'nai Noach, and yet there are laws that the Torah commands B'nai Noach. And we'll see in a moment that it's not just that the Torah commands them. We'll see that they're actually obligated to believe in the Torah. I'll show that to you. An unbelievable source we'll see in about 5 or 10 minutes, yeah?
But he says they're ever going to keep the Torah. They don't have the Torah.
Well, I don't know what you mean they don't have the Torah. The Torah was given, and apparently, the Torah is commanded to them. Now, if you said to me, who says they're ever going to believe the Torah, one answer to your question would be, Yeshayahu says they're going to believe the Torah. We just read it.
So,
it's
going to have a check. Right now, like, take an average non-Jewish street.
Maybe that's part of the problem, and maybe that's part of our job. We saw that the Rambam says that we're supposed to be going out, he actually said go out and force them. Now, whether we should be forcing them or whether we should be using other methods, that's a different discussion, and there's a lot to say about that. And certainly nowadays, nobody, I would hope, is advocating that we go on a jihad or something like that. But I do think, and this is actually the point that I'm trying to make, if one, I mean, you're already getting to the punchline, so to speak. It's an error to think that it's not my, you're right. Most of the people in this world, even if they keep the laws of B'nai Noach, we're sort of jumping ahead of ourselves. I'm going to just finish the sentence, and I'd like to come back to this point in a few minutes at the end of the shiur. But you're correct. Most of the people in the world today, even if they keep the mitzvah of B'nai Noach, will do so not because the Torah says so. They'll do so either because they just consider it part of basic morality, or maybe they'll do so because they have a different religion, let's say Christianity or Islam, which in both of those cases, it's a very interesting question whether they conform to B'nai Noach, mitzvah B'nai Noach or not. We can make a strong case that each of those religions does, and yet Christianity's got a little problem with the Bodhisattva, and Islam a little bit with Ritzicha, but, you know, and maybe with certain other points as well. But, and then we have to get into what their theology is, and the Christians actually believe that the Torah was given and then changed, and then Muslims also sort of believe that the Torah was given and then given again. So that's a fact. I'll touch on that point a little bit as well. But you're correct that most people in the world, first of all, many don't keep the mitzvahs B'nai Noach, and there are, by the way, at least 1 billion people in this world today who are still mamash ovdei elilim in the, you know, they're in places like India and Thailand and certain African countries where we may not realize this, but we've heard about this a few years ago with the Shaykhs, right? But there really is real Avodah Zarah going on in the world, not just like real people like offering sacrifices to idols. That does still exist, and in huge numbers. And certainly the other mitzvot, B'nai Noach. But even those who keep the B'nai Noach, I think you're correct, Esti, that most people in the world, even those who keep the mitzvot B'nai Noach, will not tell you that they do so because the Torah of Moshe Rabbeinu commands them to. But if your assumption is that it's not our obligation to try to teach that to them, I think that's incorrect. And I think I already showed you sources that show you that it is our obligation to teach it to them. Now you said when Mashiach comes, they will believe all of this. That may be true. Or maybe the sentence should be reversed. Maybe when they believe all of this, that's part of what it's going to take for Mashiach to come. But that's certainly the vision that Yishayahu sees at the end of days. Ki mitzion tetzei Torah udvar Hashem Yerushalayim goes out to kol ha-goyim. Okay. Things that sound impossible never stopped on Israel before. It also sounds impossible that we would come back to Eretz Israel and back to Yerushalayim and exist at all. Torah showed us that impossible things happen. Now, before we get to this point, though, and this is really the punchline that I want to get to just in just a few minutes, I want to just spend 5 minutes, though, or maybe 3 or 4 minutes on one other point, and then 3 or 4 minutes on another point, and then I'll wrap up. I spoke about certain details. For a moment, I want to talk about the conceptual framework, or the global details, let's say, of mitzvah B'nai Noach. Not only to look at the individual details of each individual law, you see differences between Am Yisrael and them, but the chiyuv in general, there are differences between Am Yisrael and them. Again, in some cases stricter on us, in some cases stricter on them. What's the punishment for violating the mitzvah B'nai Noach? The Rambam tells us, there's a machloket about this in the Gemara as well, in the Gemara Sanhedrin, Daf Nun Zayin Amud Bet, and the Rambam, it's not on your page, but in Halacha Yudalei Dei Perek Tet, the Rambam tells us that a Ben Noach who violates any one of the seven laws of Ben Noach is Chayav Mikach. Ben Noach gets the death penalty for violating any of these laws. In fact, that's the source for what he said, the source that we did see. Then in theory, at least, we would actually go out and kill B'nai Noach if they don't agree to accept these laws. It's based on that, because they're all laws that carry capital punishment. And that sounds very, very harsh. And we have to try to... And again, in practical terms, as we know from the Gemara and Makot, that a Beit Din executing a person in actual fact is a very, very rare occurrence. There are many, many, many details that have to fall into place in order for a person to actually be convicted of a death sentence in a Beit Din. And even though those details are also different from B'nai Noach, for example, they don't require hatra'ah, you don't have to warn them first, but still, I think it's safe to assume that a Beit Din would not actually be so quick to execute a person very often. However, on a conceptual level, it remains a very, very difficult concept. If we take the seven laws and look at them, and compare the onesh, the punishment that B'nai Noach get, versus the punishment that we would get if we would violate those laws, on four of them, we also would have a death sentence. Namely, Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayot, Shvichut Damin, and Birkat Hashem. Those four are capital crimes for Am Yisrael as well. So, maybe it's troublesome that those things, or some of them might be capital crimes, but we can put that on the side. That's not a difference between us and them. That leaves three laws for which they would receive a death sentence, but we would not. Okay, one of those is Binim. Perhaps that can be explained in the following way. Perhaps those of us who have Torah and Mitzvot, so we have a set of laws, and maybe it's less urgent, you know, maybe a violation of a law or a failure to set up the law would be less significant in a society where there is no Torah, and if there's no system of laws in place, then the whole society would just simply disintegrate. And maybe that's why, in fact, Dr. Raman says, that's why, halakhically, Shimon and Levi were allowed to kill the Bali Shechem, the members of the inhabitants of the city of Shechem, because clearly they didn't have a system of law and order in place. There was a lawless society, and therefore such a society has to be wiped out. Perhaps we can, you know, understand Dinim in absence of Torah as being of such significance that it requires that. That would leave two laws that it's very difficult to understand how there could be a chiyuv mita. One of them is Gezel. Imagine executing a person for theft. And out of that, even it doesn't matter how much you steal. You steal something that's worth less than a sheva pluta. You steal a paperclip. And that would carry within a death sentence for Ben Noach. And Eder Menachai. And Eder Menachai, maybe you think, okay, some kind of cruelty. It doesn't have to be cruelty. It doesn't have to be that you chop the animal's leg off. You could chop the animal's leg off and you're not chayav, only if you eat it. And even if the leg broke off by itself, and then you eat it, Ben Noach is chayav mita for that. What? In theory, and I guess in practice, the Ben Noach could be brought in front of a Jewish Beit Din and could be sentenced to death for it. Well, people don't normally go into, they could be captured by Jewish police and brought into court. Again, I'm less concerned with how likely this is to actually happen than I am with the concept behind it. What does it mean to say that a person gets capital punishment for stealing a paperclip or for eating a piece of an animal that happens to still be alive? I don't know the answer to this, but I think it's interesting that if you look at those two laws, Gezel and Eder Menachai, we seem to have two very fundamental concepts. Gezel perhaps, other than Shichud Damim, other than the murder, Gezel perhaps is the most fundamental basic requirement of respect for another person. You don't steal another person's property. And Eder Menachai, which is some sort of a dietary law, perhaps the most basic level, is requiring us, we have a full set of laws that are meant to infuse us with Kiddushah. That we separate ourselves after all. We don't just eat anything that's there. We have a whole series of regulations that governs what we eat. A Ben Noach has one single dietary law that's perhaps meant to maintain just a small modicum. An animal eats anything that it wants. Right? A person says, I eat what I'm allowed to eat, and I don't eat what I'm not allowed to eat. And therefore, these two very basic concepts, a certain very basic respect for Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, for another person, and a certain very basic respect for Kedushat HaChayim, for ourselves as people that were created, B'Tzelem Elokim, and are not animals, this is a requirement on all people. And although the death sentence is in fact very, very harsh, perhaps the idea behind this is that Bnei Noach operate with Midat Hadin. Anyone who violates God's will doesn't have a right to exist. You're created by God, and if you don't follow His instructions, then what right to existence do you have? With us, there's something called Midat HaRachamim. And apparently, for one reason or another, that's not the plane that Bnei Noach are meant to operate on. They're given a very basic set of obligations, bare minimum, if you will, and they're told, you keep these laws, then you're allowed to exist. You don't keep these laws, then you're not allowed to exist. On the other hand, however, their obligations are limited by certain things that, for example, Ben Noach is paktur, it's machloket also, but according to Rambam, Ben Noach is paktur in a case of shogeg. If he ate that Aver Menachai because he thought, he didn't realize it was Aver Menachai, he thought that it was from an animal that was dead, and he didn't understand that he was eating Aver Menachai, he's completely exempt. We would have to bring a korban in such a case. He's completely exempt. He's also completely exempt from the concept of Yehareg V'al Yavor. A Ben Noach, is never asked to sacrifice his life for God. They put a gun to his head and say, worship idols, he's allowed. Whereas Am Yisrael has a mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem, and under certain extreme conditions, we're obligated, even at the pain of death, to uphold certain principles. And a Ben Noach is not asked to do that. So again, it seems that the Bnei Noach are given a certain basic level. They're not required to reach, not to follow, not to live by the number of laws that we're meant to live by, not to live by laws that are as demanding in certain ways, but whatever basic level they have is Midat Hadin. Am Yisrael, however, has many, many, many more obligations. And we're expected to live to a much higher standard. And that's meant to be in the fulfillment of our role as what the Torah calls Mamlechet Kohanim, or what Yishayahu and Navi called Or Goyim, to be the leader of all those others, as we saw in that vision of Yishayahu as well. And that carries with it a whole slew of responsibilities and also perhaps some privileges like Midat HaRachamim, like the ability to mess up and to be given a second chance. One last thing and then we'll wrap up. If I see a non-Jewish person, I've spent the last few minutes giving a brief overview as to what the Torah says about that person's obligation. If I look at that person with the eyes of the Ish Halakha, and I want to categorize that person, give that person a status and say, well, how do I relate to this person? There are a number of different categories that Ben Noach, depending on his behavior, could fit into. This is a very complicated topic which also has many, many nuances and different opinions, and I obviously won't go through all of them. But, begadol, a non-Jewish person could be in any one of the following categories at a bare minimum. Maybe there are others. But he could be what the Gemara calls an akum, oved kochavim. Could be an idolater, a pagan, and such a person, in theory, is chayav mita. That's one possibility. But he could also be in other categories. If he keeps the mitzvah Bnei Noach, he's not an idolater, he's not a pagan, and he's actually doing all the things that the Torah demands of him, what's his status then? Well, one option is, he could reach the level of what's called Ger Toshav. Ger Toshav is a halakhic concept where a non-Jew fulfills all of the obligations, maybe not even, we'll see in a moment, but fulfills enough of the obligations that apply to him, and as a result, he's actually given the right not only to exist, we don't kill him, but not only that, he's given the right to live in Eretz Yisrael. He gets a green card. He's allowed to live in our country, even when we're in charge of the country. And not only that, he gets the rights and protections of a resident in the country. We have to provide him, we have to take care of him, and we have to protect him. Now the Gemara, that's source number 6 there, the Gemara has a machloket. What does it take to become a ger toshav? There's three opinions in the Gemara. Ezel ger toshav, kol shekibel olav b'fnei shlosha chavirim shelo lavod abudat kochavim, divri Rabbi Meir. According to Rabbi Meir, he has to get together a group of three Torah scholars and declare in front of them that he accepts the prohibition of avodah zarah. If he does that, he gets his green card. He's a ger toshav. Chachamim omrim, not enough. Kol shekibel olav zayin mitzvot shekibel olav b'nei noach. The Chachamim say he has to accept in front of those three people all the seven mitzvot. He commits to keep the seven mitzvot. He's a ger toshav. And Acherim Omrim is a third opinion, a fascinating one. Eilu lo ba'al l'tal ger toshav. They say that this is not enough to be called a ger toshav. Ela eizel ger toshav ze ger ochel nevelot. Shekibel alav l'kayim kol mitzvot amorot b'torah chutz mi'isur nevelot. That he actually has to accept all the mitzvot in the Torah. He's almost a ger. He almost became a Jewish. Just one thing, he still eats non-kosher meat. Some say it's only that, and that's because it's a pasuk that says so explicitly. Megera shibishalecha tidnen. You give it. What do you do with an animal that becomes a nevela? You give it to a ger. So that's the ger toshav. Some say he keeps 612 mitzvot, just not that one. Others say that nevela is actually a category. He keeps all mitzvot that are stricter than nevela. Anything that's chayiv kares, but not chayiv lavim. In any case, the Rambam decides according to the opinion of the Chachamim. If you look at the last source, the Rambam says something fascinating. Oh no, I'm sorry, before we get to the last source, we go back to source number 3. Source number 3, in Halacha Yud Aleph there, actually in Halacha Yud, we stopped on the third line there, we said that if he doesn't accept the Zion Mitzvah, he gets killed. Then he writes, on the Kabel Otam, Hu HaNikra Ger Toshav B'chol Makom, the Tarif LeKabel Olav B'fnei Shlosha Chavirim. Okay, so the Rambam paskins like the Chachamim, that anyone who steps in front of three Chavirim, the seven mitzvot in Noach, he's a ger toshav. And then he writes in Halacha Yud Aleph, Kol mekabel shev mitzvot in his high lasotan, harei zeh mechassidei umot haolam, v'yesh lo chelek l'olam haba. Anyone who accepts these seven laws and agrees to keep them is mechassidei umot haolam, and yesh lo chelek l'olam haba. Basically, a non-Jew who accepts and keeps those seven laws is doing everything the Torah expects of him. And he, therefore, is almost on the level of Am Yisrael. In fact, potentially higher. A person from Am Yisrael can lose their chelek and all under Bab God forbid. This person has one. He is fulfilling all of his obligations. He's an upstanding citizen of the world. But the Rambam throws in a fascinating caveat. Vehu שיקבל אותן ויעשה אותן מפני שציווה בהן הקדוש ברוך הוא בתורה והודיענו על ידי משה רבנו שבני נוח מקודם נכתבו בהן. The proviso that's required for this person to earn the status of חסידי אומות העולם ויש לו חלק עולם הבא is not only that he keeps these seven laws but that he do so because he believes in the Torah and in Moshe Rabbeinu. And he believes that the Torah told us on Har Sinai that prior to that, Bnei Noach had been commanded in these laws, and for that reason he keeps them. If he does that, then he has achieved this status. So that's what I meant when I said the outset. We expect all of the people in the world, all 6 billion of them, to believe in the Torah and to follow the Torah. It's just that the Torah doesn't command them everything it commands us. They're commanded under the system of Bnei Noach. We're commanded under the system of Bnei Israel, but it's the same Torah. Barack Obama's not totally wrong. It's not the way he thinks about it, but that's the truth. We're all children of one God. And that one God commanded all of us with the same Torah. It just has different obligations, yeah? The Torah was given at Sinai to the entire world. So we have to teach them.
They don't have an obligation to learn Torah. Or even not a...
They're not even allowed to learn Torah, but they're allowed to learn these seven mitzvot, and we're supposed to be teaching it to them. Yes, that's explicit in the Rambam, yes. They're allowed to learn these seven laws, yes. Yeah.
But if one is to teach them the seven mitzvot, how can one provide a compelling argument without teaching
them? That's a tactical question. That's a tactical question, how to do it. I don't want to get into that right now, but I want to get to one final point. Okay, but let's just finish this Rambam. What if he doesn't do that? What if he, I'll be finished in 5 minutes, what if he follows all 7 laws, but not because he believes in the Torah, just because they make sense to him? So here there's a problem with the girsa in the Rambam. What I printed on the page here is not exactly what's printed in most standard editions of the Rambam, but if you check the various girsot, it seems this is the correct original text. What did he not say? He didn't say Ein lo chelek b'olam haba. That's not clear to me. But he says Ein mechasidei umot haolam ella. The other gift is below, and that would be a fundamental change. But let's read it. Ein mechasidei umot haolam ella mechachamei. If he does the right thing, but not for the right reason, then he's not mechasidei umot haolam. But he's only mechachmei umot haolam. He's a wise person. He's a scholar. He's not a pious person. What exactly that means, and what his status is, and does he have a chelek olam haba, does he not, is all ambiguous in the Rambam, and much ink has been spilled trying to figure this out. Rav Kook has a whole analysis, as do many others. Ve'ein kam makom laharich. But one thing I think is clear from all of this is that it's a fundamental error for us to think that the Torah is only for us, and that our job is to lock ourselves up in our dalet amos, and to keep Torah mitzvot, and so the rest of the world can go to wherever they're going to go to. That's not correct. I'm not discussing right now, practically speaking, to what extent we should be interacting with them. Those are very, very important questions on the practical level, on the tactical level. Should we be going out and teaching this to them now? Should we be trying to lead them by example? Perhaps we're not ready to do that. Perhaps it's too dangerous. Perhaps the danger of being influenced by them has to temporarily override the danger of the need to influence. Those are all important questions that need to be discussed. But at the very least, let's accept the fundamental principle of the matter. That Am Yisrael's mission is for the sake of all of humanity. When I walk down the street and I see a goy walking on the other side of the street, I see a person who I have an obligation towards. I see a person who's not only a Tzelem Elokim in the sense that he's created in the image of God, but a person who's a Ben Noach, who is obligated to keep the Torah, and who my vision at the end of the day includes and requires, ultimately, that he comes to that realization. I'll conclude with one other thing that is also going to blow some people away, I think. Also very not fully known concept. The last Rambam here, which is the end of the second chapter in this little treatise, the Rambam discusses what our obligations are towards non-Jewish people. He starts with the Ger Toshav. The Ger Toshav, again, has done everything he's supposed to do. He's accepted the Zion Mitzvot, he's accepted the fact that they come from the Torah, he took upon himself an obligation based in, he has a green card, he lives in Eretz Yisrael. The Chen Yerli Shenogim in Ger Toshav, the Derech Eretz, the Gmilut Chassadim Ki Yisrael. So we have to treat them even with chesed, with kindness, just like Am Yisrael. He's almost one of us. Shere anu mitzuvim ha'chayotah. Shenema leger shev b'sharef et dinan ha'biachla. Skip the next line here, and then, but, he writes, afilu ha'atum. But even the idolaters, even the pagans, who theoretically we should be killing. You have to figure out how that fact jives with this next fact, and that's what I meant before when I said it's not so clear that the Rambam's advocating jihad here, and that's a whole other discussion. But the Rambam writes here, Afil ha'akum, sibu chachamim, mevaker cholehem, we should be visiting their sick, v'lekvor meitehem, we should bury their dead, im meitei Yisrael, obviously doesn't mean bury them next to each other, we're not allowed to do that, but we have to take care of them the same way we take care of ourselves, u'lufarnes aniyehem, we have to support their poor people, b'chlal aniyeh Yisrael, we should be giving charity to them, not just to ourselves. Why? Ritnei darkei shalom. What? So that's what most people think. It says here, Ritnei darkei shalom. When most people read the phrase darkei shalom, they think that what that means is, how do you think that phrase means, darkei shalom?
That they don't kill us.
That they don't kill us, so that we don't get into fights with them. It keeps things very practically moving on a pragmatic level. That's a mistake, at least in the Rambam. There is such a concept in Allah. That's called Mishum Eva. And the Rambam didn't say Eva. The Rambam said Darkei Shalom. If you want to know what he means by that, read the end of the sentence. Vipnei Darkei Shalom. Hare Ne'emar, Tov Hashem Lakol, V'rachamav Al Kol Ma'asav, V'ne'emar, D'racheha Darkei Noam, V'chol Netivoteha Shalom. When the Rambam speaks about Darkei Shalom, he's not talking about be nice to them so they don't kill you. Darkei Shalom means Derachea Darkei Noam, the phone of people say Shalom. Darkei Shalom means the Derech HaTorah. The Torah commands us to be kind people. You see a poor person in the street, you say, well, he's not one of my own kind, so I'm not going to give him any money. And you're not really following the Torah. And you're not really able to communicate the Torah to others. And that, SD, might be at least one answer to your question. How am I supposed to explain this all to them? I'm not sure I have the full answer to you, but perhaps one way to start is by modeling a certain type of behavior. That if we have the cognizance, not only, again, that we're worried about on a practical level, we have to make sure that we don't get into fights, and, you know, especially we're living here in Chutzlaris, and what's going to be, and we want to make sure that we have good neighborly relations, and, you know, new government, what's going to be, whatever is on people's minds, that all may be true. But woe be unto us if it stops there. Again, I'm not at the present time discussing the practical questions, the very difficult questions of exactly how we should put this into play on a practical level, and to what percentage of our resources and our time and our energy should be expended on this, and at what cost. Those are very important discussions, and they require more time than we have now. But the fundamental principle, that the Torah is not about us, it's not about our relationship with Hashem, not only as individuals, not even only as a community, not even as a nation. The Torah is about redeeming the entire world, and ultimately, at least, that's our mission. Our mission is to redeem all of humanity and to ultimately bring the world to Yeshayahu's vision of the end of days. How to do that, I leave some other shiur. Thank you for listening.